Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
For a social system that lasted many centuries, patriarchy never really worked all that well. In addition to the disregard for the full human rights of women, the economy is not served by keeping half the adult population largely out of the workforce. But here's the thing. Moving beyond patriarchy has its challenges, too. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The prospect of building a new, more egalitarian world is exciting and empowering for women and for the men who love and respect them. Moving men into roles once reserved for women and vice versa may make the world more equal in the end. In the meantime, though, men and women alike are treading into territory that feels unsettled. And instead of battling for power, we will need to learn to share. Stephen Marsh is contributing editor at Esquire magazine, and he writes for The Atlantic and The New York Times. His new book is called The Unmade Bed, The Messy Truth About Men and Women in the 21st Century. He joins us this hour from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. Stephen, welcome back to Think.
Pleasure to be here, Chris.
This is not a book about the battle of the sexes. You argue throughout that we are in this together, and you say it's not men against women or fathers against mothers. It is families against money.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was both my personal experience and sort of the deep research that I did into the statistical and economic roots of the gender transformation made that pretty clear to me, which is a sign actually of how hopeful the situation is, because the deep trends of gender over the past century are that men and women get more and more equal all the time and continue to do so. No matter who is in power, how bad things look, the deep trend is really positive.
So as couples make decisions, and not every couple has to make this decision, but about which career might take precedence, almost everybody who's making this choice looks at the dollars and cents.
Yeah, I mean, that was the sort of, when I left, the book was sort of prompted by the collective decision my wife and I made. I was a professor in New York and loved my job, and she was offered a job in Toronto, and so we really had to kind of make this choice whether I was going to be a professor or she was going to have her dream job. And really, like, it all came down to money. And I think there, more than that, there was sort of a big generational shift. Like, I think for people of my parents' age, I'm 40. So people like of the boomers, that decision seemed kind of radical for a man to give up his job for his wife's career. But for people my own age, it was actually just really totally par for the course. Like, it was just totally normal. Like, of course, you're going to make more money in Toronto, so you go back there.
It's entirely logical, but you were still struck by the feeling that you had become your wife's husband, something that bothered you even though you supported her career and you had this deeply held belief that, she as a woman had a right to a fulfilling job. It was hard anyway, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is that the future that we're going towards, which is one that is more equality, in which both members of the household work, in which both members of the household take care of kids, that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to be happier. You know what I mean? Like, I think I was not very happy just being a mammal. Like being a, like taking care of the babies and just dealing with the stuff of the flesh, which of course has this inherent dissatisfaction in it that you never get any sense of achievement. It just goes on and on and on and on. And so, like, we eventually fought our way to some kind of compromise where we both could take care of the kids and we both could try to change the world in our own little ways. I think one of the things that is that, as we get closer to dealing with a reality where men and women sort of live together on equal terms, that doesn't necessarily mean that things are easier. Maybe it's not. It's definitely happier, but is it easier? I don't think it is.
My husband and I have joked that we could use someone who does the job that was traditionally associated with a wife.
The third wife, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the book I should have written. I should have written like a call for the third partner and the spouse. I mean, the third spouse. I mean, I know it would make life so it would actually fulfill life perfectly,
You note that there was a time when men were encouraged to express themselves more, in part because the women in their lives wanted to talk with them and weren't getting that. Today, we have the situation where men are sometimes criticized for this thing called mansplaining. First of all, for the uninitiated, what does mansplaining mean?
Well, mansplaining is a term that was sort of coined by author and activist Rebecca Solnit. And it described a very common social reality perfectly, which is she had this experience where she was at a party and a man started lecturing her about her own book. Right. Like she'd written a book and then he sort of told her how he understood more. And I mean, I knew a woman who started dating again after her husband died and she was in her mid-50s. And she described it as male explanatory syndrome. Hmm. Like that was her phrase for it, where it's just like you go to some guy and you say, yeah, I'm a professor of physics. And he says, oh, well, let me tell you all about like the three laws of thermodynamics. You know what I mean? Like we've all seen this. Like this is all very, very real. And these guys definitely do exist. On the other hand, I think male speech is vastly more complicated, and its position in our current reality is vastly more complicated than men talk too much. In fact, I kind of think on some issues, particularly about gender, men don't talk at all. I mean, I've done maybe 40, 45 interviews about this book, which is about men and women. Only one man has talked to me about it, right? Like everyone else, every single other person I've talked to about it has been a woman, because women actually think about gender and think about their gender roles and gender norms and how these things are constructed and built and talk about it. And men, like nothing is less manly than talking about manliness. So men just clam up about it. And I think male silence on this problem is actually morphing into something of a crisis.
That's really interesting because it calls to mind a parallel. You know, I think white Americans are often criticized for not thinking and talking enough about race.
Right. Well, and you know, and they should, and they're the ones who need to talk about it because they're the ones who are damaged, right? I mean, they're the ones who have the pathology. You know, that was something that James Baldwin always said, that it was like that the problems of American race were that white people had not figured out what their damage was. And like, and I think for men, I think that's doubly true, except, you know, the crisis that's coming for men is that, the economy is changing, and men are not changing in response to it. And because of that, they're suffering an enormous amount. I mean, we've heard a lot about the Case Deaton report where, the male suicide rate is a crisis. You know, it is a full-on public health crisis, which, I mean, Case Deaton say it's comparable to the mortality rate of AIDS in the 80s. Women's jobs are 13 of the 15 fastest-growing jobs in the economy. Men are basically not doing those jobs because of gender norms, right? I mean, they're not taking healthcare jobs, which are growing really quickly, simply because they're too stubborn not to, and this damages them, and so like I think it's like it is a crisis, but it's more than like it's not just feelings or like it's not just a question of like trying to be a better person. It's actually that this is really harming them, and of course, you know, when it harms men, it harms women, inevitably.
You say that women have found and defined dozens of ways to be a woman, as trailblazer or traditionalist or banker or scientist. Men, in your observation, are too hung up on how not to be a man.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the crux of the problem, really, when you look around. Like, you know, men, when you ask a man what their experience of, they're the very... And of course, increasingly, the positive things that you can say are inherently manly are narrowing enormously. I mean, you know, it used to be you could say that joining the military would have been a manly experience, but of course, that no longer. Like women are joined that long ago. Women are commanders of submarines. You know, this is the future has arrived. And so as that future has arrived, men have not really found ways to define themselves with more openness. You know, instead, they've restricted themselves more and more. And of course, that's how you get these parodies of masculinity who walk around, one of whom is the president of the United States, you know, who can't tie a tie and can't shake hands properly and, you know, cannot do the things that every father teaches his son how to do when he's 10 years old. But, you know, I think the root cause of this is actually like a very a closing off that's sort of more horrible even on its own, notwithstanding the consequences of it.
I will say, I mean, my world is maybe sheltered, but it's full of enlightened men who care about women and are not, you know, constantly trying to prove their dominance.
Of course.
But, I mean, you describe a climate where a lot of people are adrift. It's no longer obvious what men are supposed to be in our society, if women have taken their place beside men in roles that used to belong only to men.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not just that. It's that women are, like, women are 40% of breadwinners in the United States, right? I mean, women are 60% of college graduates. They're more graduate. I mean, there are a couple of things that are happening at once. I think it's really important to say here. Like, it would be ridiculous to say of men, like, woe is me, like how bad things are for men when, you know, look who's in power. Right. And the phrase I use to describe this is the hollow patriarchy, because two things are happening at once. One is, women are rising through the middle class, and they're rising to dominate the middle class. They're, you know, approaching the majority of undergraduates. It's their jobs that are growing and men's jobs that are shrinking. When you look at jobs like truck driving is about to be eviscerated by auto, by Uber, by self-driving trucks. And that's the largest employer of middle class men in 29 states in the United States. When that goes, this is going to be a very real crisis for every man who does not write code, you know? And so you have, that is all happening. And at the same time, there's no point denying this. Men control the top tier positions in almost every field and dominate them in a way that is, you know, more or less, it's not just like Hollywood directors, for whom, you know, 97% of Hollywood directors are male. It's also things like equity partnerships and law firm, which is only 16% female, or board memberships. You know, I live in Canada, supposedly feminist paradise. You know, 6% of board members are female in this country. Right. So this process, which is underway, is kind of double. One is that women are growing to power in the middle class, but men remain iconic of power, and they retain the phrase is the hollow patriarchy, where there's this new kind of toxic machismo and alpha dog bluster, whereas women are actually like running the main parts of the economy. So like that process is. It's complicated. It's neither, like, I think it becomes more helpful when you stop thinking about who is a victim and who isn't a victim, and you start thinking about what the processes at work actually are. And those processes at work are very turbulent and very, very difficult to negotiate.
My guest is Stephen Marsh. He's contributing editor at Esquire magazine. He also writes for The Atlantic and The New York Times. His new book is called The Unmade Bed, The Messy Truth About Men and Women in the 21st Century. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for aspiring creative writers. You can nurture your creative talents and take courses this summer like Our Stories, Ourselves. You can apply now at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm gonna go do the dishes.
Cool.
It'd be nice if you help me.
No problem. Get them a little bit later. I'm just gonna hit the streets here for a little bit.
Gary, come on. I don't want to do them later. Let's just do them now. Take 15 minutes.
Oh, honey, I am so exhausted. I just honestly want to relax for a little bit. If I could just sit here, let my food digest, and just try to enjoy the quiet for a little bit. Get some. Get some. Get some. That's what happens. And we will, you know, we can clean the dishes tomorrow.
Gary, you know, I don't like waking up to a dirty kitchen.
Who cares?
I care, all right? I care. I busted my all day cleaning this house and then cooking that meal, and I worked today. It would be nice if you said thank you and helped me with the dishes.
Fine. I'll help you do the damn dishes.
Oh, come on. You know what? No, that's not what I want.
You just said that you want me to help you do the dishes.
I want you to want to do the dishes.
Why would I want to do dishes? Why?
See, that's my whole point.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was a clip from the 2006 film The Breakup. You heard Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston. My guest for the hour is Stephen Marsh. He's a contributing editor at Esquire who writes for The Atlantic and The New York Times. His new book is called The Unmade Bed, The Messy Truth About Men and Women in the 21st Century. We played that clip.
It's Stephen, a great clip.
Yeah, it is.
I wish I'd known that before I wrote the book. I would have put it in there somewhere.
Nobody wants to do housework. Nobody.
Well, housework is one of the most fascinating intellectual questions I've ever dealt with, because it seems so simple. It seems so obvious. It feels so natural. But when you actually dig below the surface, it's just an incredibly complicated question. Like, even the question of what it is. Like, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, like, you know, the inventor of Marxism, they really couldn't decide what it was, what kind of labor housework was. For Engels, it was alienated labor. It was just like, which was like factory work. So that meant that in the future, it would all be, in the great communist era to come, there would be no more housework. But for Marx, it was care labor. And that meant that you would do housework after the communist revolution. Like, you would do that because it was craft, because it was like caring for your environment, that it would never go away. So even they couldn't decide on what it was. And, you know, that got transferred into later debates in feminism. Like, Simone de Beauvoir said that no healthy woman would ever care for housework, that it was just sort of this hangover from patriarchy. And then, of course, in the 80s, it became really sort of like one of the disrespected forms of women's work. So it got, you know, even the sort of greatest feminist thinkers can't really decide what housework is.
I think on top of this question of who should do what based on gender, if that is an issue, is the fact that, you know, within couples, there are often different priorities about what matters. You know, you might think the room is clean if you've made the bed, and I might not feel like it's clean until the baseboards have been dusted.
Well, that's it. I mean, the thing about the hygiene of a house, much like the hygiene of a body, is that, like, if I don't have a shower every day, I feel disgusting, mm-hmm. right? Like, I feel like I haven't, I'm unclean. But that's totally historically abnormal.
Right.
I mean, you know, like, that's just, like, it feels totally natural to me. It's just totally constructed as well. So, and a house is the same way. Like, what needs to be done, like, what feels like it needs to be done, it feels as natural as how clean you have to be. But on the other hand, it's obviously totally constructed. It's totally constructed by the society you're in.
One thing you discovered, you know, there have been many, many headlines about the fact that women are still doing more housework than men, and that remains true. But as it turns out, women are also starting to do less. So we're giving ourselves a break from certain chores, and we're doing maybe a little more on average. This is not every couple than men, but we're all starting to just do less housework.
I didn't expect, you know, there's a lot in this book about various controversial things like pornography and all this stuff.
We'll get
there. But this stuff was the most controversial. Like, these housework studies would show, like, men have not changed the amount of housework they've done since the 80s. And that's everywhere. That's in the Netherlands and Australia and America, every advanced economy. Canada, it doesn't matter. Portugal, makes no difference. And if you think about the changes that men have done on every other field, like men are spending about three times more with their kids than they spent in the 60s. Right, they're doing way more cooking. They're doing way more. They're much more engaged, and they've made a lot of progress in a lot of things. But housework, no change whatsoever. At the same time, I mean, the irony is that women are the sociological term for it is disinvestment. So that means it's not only that you care less how dirty your own house is; it's that you also judge your friends less for how dirty their houses are. And that leads to a kind of thing where, you know, men aren't doing any more housework, but women are doing a lot less. So we're actually getting towards equality, but not because men are getting any better, but just because women are caring less.
Equality equals squalor.
Well, eventually we'll all get, I mean, that's the sort of argument in the book that if the trends continue, which they look like they, you know, they've been ongoing for 35 years, like that we'll all be living in dirty. In a way, we are already living in dirtier houses, right? I mean, like my mother, you know, who was a physician, still cleaned the parlor in our house every week, right? And, you know, my grandmother vacuumed drapes. I have such a clear memory of her doing that, like vacuuming
thing,
the drapes.
Yeah.
The extension thing. And then there was like, you know, dusting every day, stuff like that. Like, you know, that's all gone. And do we really miss it? Like, I don't think so. I think this is just a win. Like, we're getting more and more, we're spending more and more times on things other than random, like cleaning houses. That seems to me like a good thing.
All right, perfect segue to get back to your chapter on pornography, which I will say is a lengthy chapter within this book. You have an interesting take on this, and you go into lots of things in great detail, but a lot of feminists see porn as degrading to women, likely to create unrealistic expectations about real-life sex. You note studies that show access to pornography has been associated with a decrease in sexual violence.
Well, the thing that is so, like, much like the hollow patriarchy thing, I think like so much of this debate has been consumed in frankly moralism and moral panic. And I think when you look at it, like the way we have to start treating pornography as a public health issue, which, you know, people in Utah have done in a completely misguided way, in one of the most misguided, you know, policies about human sexuality ever undertaken in the United States. I mean, there are two things that are happening at once. If you show men pornography, the immediate response, like in the immediate aftermath of that, they will show increased tolerance towards violence against women, increased aggressiveness, and that has been replicated hundreds of times. Like it's not really debatable. And I think that's what a lot of the early feminist critiques of pornography emerged from, is from that sociological work. But on the other hand, it's also very clear when you look at studies of the effects of pornography in communities. Like, for example, pornography first arrived, you know, one thing is that pornography tends to arrive alongside women's liberation and women's liberation movement. So the origin of the Stag movie was really Sweden in the 50s, which was also, you know, the greatest egalitarian society in the world at that point. And then it moved into Germany, and then it moved into the United States in the 80s. And, you know, over and over and over again, it's very clear, like Japan is another big example where there was this huge glut of pornography in the 80s, and sexual violence rates decreased. The reason I think it's really important to deal with this is that the scope of how much pornography is being consumed is staggering. I mean, that's the only word for it. I mean, some of these sites, like, well, there was one site that released its data accidentally, and it was twice as big as CNN and Hulu put together. And that was one random free site. Like, you know, and they're all cloistered in these, like, very separated, like, you know, they don't have to release any information at all. But, like, the amount of data that is being streamed through these sites is just simply incredible. And so, like, I think what we need here is really, rather than moralism, we really need a public health kind of approach to it, and a kind of like Dr. Ruth approach to it, if I can, you know, so like a 1970s, like, let's just be frank about the realities of human sexuality approach to it. And in that case, like, I think what we're dealing with is, you know, some of the research into this stuff is very new, and it's really, really weird. It tells all sorts of different and conflicting stories, and not all of them are just simple horror stories.
To be clear, we have correlation, and that may equal causation, and it may not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, no one, you know, there is causation in those early studies. Like, they can show pretty clearly, like, if you show men pornography for 6 weeks and then you show another group of men, not, you know, just normal films for 6 weeks, at the end of those 6 weeks, the men who watch pornography will want rapists to have lower jail sentences than the men who didn't watch pornography, right? Like, in that case, it's pretty clearly causation. The other stuff is just simply correlation. But on the other hand, you know, if there was this huge glut of pornography and pornography caused violence, then you would expect this enormous outpouring of this huge rise in sexual violence. And, you know, that just doesn't happen when pornography arrives in any given country. And also, you know, pornography tends to be illegal in the most patriarchal societies, Saudi Arabia, Iran, places where women's rights are denied. So all I'm saying is it is a much more new, we don't really understand the mechanism at all. And we have to start understanding it because it's very, very complicated and hugely important.
My guest is Stephen Marsh, contributing editor at Esquire magazine, who also writes for The Atlantic and The New York Times. His new book is called The Unmade Bed, The Messy Truth About Men and Women in the 21st Century. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go to the phones now and speak with Joyce in LaGrange. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I am calling because I want to start going to the solution for men where they are today. We understand it. I started out programming computers in 72, so I'm doing so much more now. And I've managed men for years, decades. I have been partnered with them, of course, being in tech. But I've also raised two sons, had a 41-year marriage. How do we get men to start saying what's really on their mind?
God, I wish I knew. I mean, you've been around them longer than I have. Do you have any ideas? Like, I mean, I tried. I did a thing where I wrote a piece for the New York Post where I said, like, women, please, you know, because I had, like, I do feel like part of this book, there's a real legitimate health concerns for men. Like, for example, men don't take their friendships seriously, so they lose their friendships. And then, of course, they have this, when they have this huge loneliness spike that leads to death. Like, it's a legitimate, it's not just feelings, it's like mortality problems. And then, you know, men not taking women's jobs equally is just sort of like, it's just a ridiculous kind of mistake. Like, you're losing out on being a provider to your family because of these outdated gender norms that no one believes in anyway. So, I mean, I took the desperate step of writing a piece for the New York Post saying, women, please cut this out and give it to the men in your lives because they need to know this stuff and they're not learning it. So, you know, I wish I knew. I've been trying my best, you know, but I wrote this stuff for Esquire that's in this book. But, you know, it's very hard to know when men are going to start paying attention. They seem to be doing the other thing, which is just running into ludicrous games of misogyny. You know, like, I did a piece on the red pill for the Guardian newspaper, and, like, you know, that was men talking about what it meant to be a man, but in the crudest and sort of, I mean, for lack of, I don't like this word, but the stupidest way imaginable. So I think men have a long way to go, and I'm not particularly filled with a lot of hope, to be honest. I mean, you know, I'm kind of two minds about it because, like, men have made oddly, they've made some really impressive progress in certain ways, like in childcare. They really, like, you can look at the numbers. It's very heartening. And, you know, I think also when you look at also the general trends, like women against violence against women is down, like, and it has been going down for a long time. So, like, I don't think I don't feel despair, but I do feel like men talking about their feelings, men talking about gender, I don't even know how it's going to begin. I really don't.
Well, for a long time, it seems to me that an impediment to men forming close relationships to other men was that our society really frowned on men being perceived as gay. As that begins to change, as nobody thinks it's an insult if someone thinks you're gay, if you are gay, will that make it easier for heterosexual men to have and display close bonds to their guy friends?
I mean, I don't know how true that is, like how deep the feeling that homosexuality was a worry for male friendships. I mean, I think to me, other cultural factors are at work. I mean, just because, like, you know, the male iconography for a long time, especially in the United States, has been like the cowboy, the mm-hmm. astronaut, the lonely, the man who goes out alone and conquers the world and then, you know, builds his own life, the Jeffersonian dream of like a farm that you just own and, you know, and you're as far as possible from other people, like that dream of isolation. I mean, I'm not sure how much of that is fueled by homophobia. To me, it's very doubtful. I mean, like, I think what's happened is that we live in an age of loneliness. Like, we live in an age where loneliness is spreading, and already and these male ideals of isolation, of glorious isolation, of, you know, self-reliance, are just sort of morphing into a kind of like toxic asociability. And so, like, that's why I don't take a lot of, I do think homophobia, by any measure, it's pretty much on the decline, pretty steadily. But I don't think that's going to affect male friendships because, you know, the other thing is, like, when you look around culture, like, male friendship is almost always stupid, right? Like, it's almost always portrayed as, like, you're doing idiotic things with your buddies and then you wait. And then whereas women grow into their friendships, they mature into their friendships, men mature out of their friendships. And that's very dangerous, very toxic.
My guest is Stephen Marsh. We're talking about his new book, The Unmade Bed, The Messy Truth About Men and Women in the 21st Century. We'll come back in 2 minutes. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your appreciation of great works of art by customizing your study with courses this fall like Inspiring Creativity Through Original Art. You can apply now at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Stephen Marsh, a contributing editor at Esquire, who also writes for The New York Times and The Atlantic. He's got a new book out called The Unmade Bed, The Messy Truth About Men and Women in the 21st Century. Steve, even as we awaken to the reality that masculinity and femininity exist on a continuum, we have inherited this culture that associates gender with everything. You know, a sandwich is manly and a sofa mm-hmm. is feminine. It's strange that our language doesn't have this, but our culture does.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the great difficulties in the book was trying to get at that reality because it's so hard. I mean, you know, like the one thing I really wanted to do when I wrote this book is only write about things that I was sure of, mm-hmm. you know, which is actually when you're writing about gender, that's usually not what you do. You only write about the things that nobody understands, right? I wanted to write about things where I felt like I had a really good grasp on what the research was and that the research was very definitive. And, you know, the gender distinction is not one of, even though I did talk about that, but because it's so important, but the gender distinction is actually very hard to deal with because it's, you know, it's some studies, like neurological studies will show gender difference from people from 6 months, and it seems essential. On other hands, gender is just a spectrum, like, and very impressive meta studies have showed that on virtually every trait that you can name. You know, the truth is that I think there's this idea out there. This, again, is one of those ideas that feels so natural but is entirely constructed, that gender is just some kind of construct. You know, that's just not true, really. Like, it's just not. On the other hand, no one can really tell you where masculinity and femininity begin, where one begins and the other doesn't. So, like, that is one of the more complicated parts of being a human being, I think. You would think it would be easier in English when we don't really have gendered language.
Yeah.
You know? Like every word in Hebrew is gendered. Like, every number is gendered, right? And every, you know, you can't say I is different for a man and for a woman. We don't have that. But at the same time, like, it's like, I think every aspect of culture is gendered, and duality is kind of, you know, part of the essence of being a human being, I think.
You talk about only wanting to write what you were sure about. One thing that makes this book really interesting is that you invited your wife, who is an editor, to weigh in, make comments, and they're included as footnotes in a number of places in the book. And often she disagrees with you.
Yeah, I really felt like, I mean, that happened accidentally. Like, my wife is an editor. She's a wonderful editor, and she edits everything that I do. And as she was editing this book, she would, you know, her usual notes would be like, you're an idiot, or can you please, like, learn how to speak English, or, you know, you're 40 years old, surely you don't have to have comma splices anymore, things like that in the margins. But this time she sort of left, like, long notes, like, page and a half long notes. And, you know, it would have been absurd for me as a man to try and incorporate this female perspective into my own text. But on the other hand, I felt like without that comment, without that aspect of the story, like, a big part of the narrative was being lost. And I also sort of feel like when you're, you know, it is a sociologically based book, but it's also a memoir of a marriage. And I do sort of feel like, whenever you read memoirs of marriages, you're always being lied to. Like, not intentionally, but accidentally. Like, you're only getting half the story. So why not just try and have both sides of the story? And as we all know, in marriages, people disagree. Like, I think we could all agree on that, right?
Yes. I've never known a marriage that didn't have some disagreement. I want to go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Anthony in Frisco. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
When you guys were talking earlier about the change in breadwinners, I've actually had that happen in my own life. My wife and I lived in Pennsylvania. We both had corporate jobs, and my wife had an opportunity to move ahead, to advance pretty rapidly by moving to a company down here in Plano. And we, you know, had the discussion that, you know, okay, well, my income wouldn't be there for a little while we try to get it back up. So we made the move, and her career has really taken off, and she's moved up a couple levels and everything, and she, you know, she is by far the dominant breadwinner in the household, and I've been sort of struggling with the fact that, well, I'm not as integral to that aspect of it, so I became more of, like, you know, Mr. Dad, you know, taking over a lot of those duties, but it also allowed me the time to sort of, like, well, what do I want to do? What would I, you know, really want to have happened? And in the past year and a half, I've actually, I'm a freelance video producer, but I've opened my own studio up here in Frisco, which I wouldn't have had the time to do if I was working a full-time job.
Isn't that wonderful? I mean, like, this is a very happy story. Like, I think this is, and, you know, and, like, what is, this is great. This is the way things are supposed to be, I think. You know, I mean, like, this is the future that we're all moving to, where it's not even that we want it to move that way. It's just that it has to because of money. But it's like, it's perfectly, that seems to me, like, wonderful. A lot of the times in our debates around gender, we just get so flummoxed because there's so much outrage, you know, because God knows there's enough to be outraged about. But I think, really, when you look at the deeper trends and you look at the substance of people's actual lives in this new era, like, there is a great deal of hope in this messy, you know, I call it, the final chapter of the book is called The Messy Hope. And, like, I just think, like, yeah, it's like, I'm not sure about my feelings. On the other hand, I'm spending a lot of time with the kids and I'm doing what I want. And my wife is doing what she wants. So this is a win. Like, I just think that's the future, that's a hopeful future.
You know, maybe it's a small thing, but I think it's noteworthy that Anthony called himself Mr. Dad. I think 15 years ago, he would have said Mr. Mom, and we don't need to use that language anymore.
Thank God. I mean, you know, like the stereotype of the stay-at-home father is still pretty poor. I mean, you know, it was only a couple of years ago that Pampers ran those ads about, like, how Pampers could survive even a father, right? Like, father with these incredible bumbling incompetence, you know. This was like 20 years old. And then there was an activist dad population, which, I mean, just consider what that even exists is itself in some ways phenomenal. But, like, you know, on television, like, the stereotypical dad is not our friend Andrew from Frisco. Did I get that right? It's like, you know, Everybody Loves Raymond, where he's just like, which is a joke because everybody hates Raymond, or, you know, Peter Griffin, or Homer Simpson, who are sort of, you know, who, like, worships a waffle stuck on the ceiling.
Like, not right? The smartest, most capable human beings, right?
Well, I think Peter Griffin is literally classified as handicapped, mentally handicapped. So, yeah, like, beyond not just smart, like just totally incompetent. And that too is that's going into the past too, I think.
What can we learn, Stephen, about the equality in relationships by looking at relationships of same-sex couples?
Well, it's a very fascinating thing when you look at the research, because, like, you know, the largest study of social mobility ever undertaken, huge. Catastrophically huge, out of Harvard, the number one correlation they found between upward mobility and social mobility generally was living in a neighborhood and living in a family with both parents, basically. And which is an incredible fact. I mean, think about how much of local politics, all politics really, is about the school system, is about, you know, increasing growth, increasing economic, you know, the size of prosperity. None of that matters to social mobility or to opportunity as much as, you know, having a family with two people in it and a stable family. And the one exception is, of course, gay families, where there's not a mom and a dad. There's both, and they are just as successful by every metric as straight parents. So I think, like, what we're seeing is that the family can be reorganized. The family unit as a force is absolutely as essential as it's ever been. It's as essential as it was in the caveman era. Like, it's absolutely the core social unit, and will always be that way. But within that, it is absolutely possible that the family can be totally reinvented, and reinvented along lines that we would have been inconceivable 30 years ago, and still have exactly the same effect. So I think that's the lesson for straight people, is really that, you know, the ways of building a family are should be more open. And, you know, you can have all that is wonderful about having a strong family and all the advantages that come with that without the, you know, traditional garb of it.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Marsh, contributing editor at Esquire and author of The Unmade Bed, The Messy Truth About Men and Women in the 21st Century. Back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Monica in San Antonio. Hi, Monica.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that when I first got married, I had the highest paying job, and I made my husband stay home for a year and a half with a baby while I went off and did my thing. And now he is out doing his thing, and I'm home. My question was, is why do we have to have gender roles like this? Do you think I think I know you beg to differ. I think there are a lot more social constructs than not. I find it that we have very different roles than most people, yet completely, you know, one male, one female. I don't like to clean. I don't like to do anything of the house. I never have, and I still don't. And we work fine. And unlike most couples, we hardly ever argue, and he does speak his mind. And actually, I've always met men that speak their mind. I don't know if it's living in San Antonio, which is a military city, but I've been around groups of men my whole life, different kinds, including now internet, stay-at-home children that just meet each other on the internet. And the men are very close to each other, and they speak their mind more than most women I know.
Well, it sounds like it's working out for Monica.
Yeah, it sounds great. I mean, you know, there is what it, as I've gone around and done this, like the cleanly man, like the male exception in cleanliness, there are like two types of them I found: military guys and architects. like you know, some like I'll be talking to a woman, she's like, "Well, my husband's a lot cleaner than me," and I'll be like, "Oh, really?" And then it always turns out that it's one of those two types: either he's in the military or he's an architect, because the architects are like, you know, freakishly need everything to be designed perfectly and are constantly aware of their space. And I guess I don't know why the military guys. I guess it's because they have, you know, because of military discipline, right? But yeah, like I don't think I would criticize. I mean, I'm in favor entirely of the flux of gender norms. I'm trying in this book not to really value it one way or the other. Like that to me is less interesting than the actual reality that's happening. It seems to me like the reality is happening, and it is, and the change is coming, and it's mostly because of economic reasons. And then we're playing catch up sort of culturally and emotionally and in our domestic lives, and we're not playing catch up very well, and particular men aren't playing catch up very well, and so like I would never criticize these choices. That's not really the kind of person I am. That's not the kind of book this is. I'm just trying to understand the mechanism behind it, and also like where it's going wrong, because I think like a lot of things are going right, but you don't have to look very far to find things that are going wrong either. So, you know, Monica sounds like a blissful marriage. You know, everyone speaks their mind and nobody cares about the housework. Sounds great.
You say caring less is the hope of the future.
Well, for housework. I mean, because like that is the one thing, like caring less is like, well, that, I mean, I'm trying to demystify these sociological terms, but like disinvestment, that's all that means, mm-hmm. is not caring. Like but it also means genuinely not caring about other people either. So when you go over and your friend's house isn't spotless, you don't think, God, she's a failure, right? Like, but that's happening all the time.
Stephen Marsh is contributing editor at Esquire magazine. He writes for The Atlantic and The New York Times as well. His new book is called The Unmade Bed, The Messy Truth About Men and Women in the 21st Century. Stephen, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us.
Pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. And if you want to subscribe to the podcast and learn about upcoming shows, you can go to think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.